From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a critical question for post-bankruptcy Detroit.
Can the city, with what is removed from its balance sheet, pay the bills that it's going to have?
It's easy to kind of start off on a good base, but then costs start to creep up over time.
Once they chased Butch Cassidy and Jesse James, now the legendary Pinkerton Company moves to Michigan.
Look, we're not on horseback anymore, and so we're protecting things in a digital space now.
And a salute to Michigan's Civil War reenactors.
You ask about the authenticity, it's insane. Right down to the underwear, right down to the socks, right down to the boots.
We really wanted to pay tribute to these people who are out there in 100-degree weather in wool.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Detroit's bankruptcy. There are high hopes that it will fix the city's finances. But what happens after bankruptcy? Will Detroit actually be able to pay its bills?
It's easy to kind of start off on a good base, but then costs start to creep up over time.
I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, what will Detroit look like post-bankruptcy? Then a legendary brand name in America's history is moving its worldwide headquarters to Ann Arbor. We'll find out who and why later this hour. But first, we're about 2.5 months away from the November general election with two big statewide races, the race for governor and U.S. Senate. We're seeing a lot of advertisements for these campaigns, but so far, no debates between the candidates. Michigan Radio's political analyst Jack Lesenberry is here. Jack, fill us in. What's going on?
Well, it's always a question of debates. I mean, they become sort of institutionalized, but usually front runners don't want to have them because they give their challenger a shot at things. And if you look at the history of presidential debates, the first one ever was in 1960, and John F. Kennedy is commonly believed to have so outclassed Richard Nixon he won the election. And that spooked everybody from having debates for a long time. And the next ones didn't happen until 1976 when President Ford was behind Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter was confident. Both felt they had nothing to lose. But this year in Michigan, you can sort of understand Governor Snyder, Rick Snyder, not wanting to debate Mark Schauer. The polls are close, but most people know Snyder better than they do Schauer, and he doesn't want to give Schauer an advantage and make himself more known and perhaps more appealing to the public. The puzzling thing is the race for Senate, where Terry Lynn Land is the margins vary, but virtually every poll shows that she's behind and falling further behind Gary Peters. And normally in a case like that, Peters would not want debates, Land would, but here it seems to be exactly the opposite because Terry Lynn Land doesn't do very well with the press, and she hasn't done very well in being questioned in public settings. She had a very famous sort of meltdown at Mackinac Island in May, and she sort of avoided the press and anything like a debate ever since. But, you know, these things can change, and I wouldn't be surprised if we ended up having some form of debate in both races.
Well, I know that Land says she looks forward to what she calls joint appearances. I'm not sure what that means, and we know that Gary Peters has said yes to 3 debate invitations, but the idea of joint appearances, it's kind of hard to know what she means by that.
Well, that's an interesting, I'm glad you mentioned that, because the so-called presidential debates, for example, are not really debates in a high school or college debating sense. They're really joint press conferences. We have both candidates on stage, and the press asks them questions, and they respond and maybe do a little back and forth with each other. In the case of the presidential cycle, especially the primaries, we almost certainly have too many debates now. During the primary season, there are dozens and dozens of debates with all these candidates on stage, and to the point where everybody gets sick of them. But I think you can argue, and I would argue, that the public has a right to see the major candidates for major offices, and there should be some debates on probably both commercial and public television for races like governor and senator.
But I wonder, what are we as viewers really gaining when we know that they're so coached and so rehearsed? And as you point out, they're really not debates. They're sparring with speeches.
Well, of course, and it's very interesting. If you look at the Kennedy-Nixon debates, the people who heard them on the radio overwhelmingly thought Nixon had won them because he was trying to make points in a sort of debating sense and convey information. But everybody almost who saw them on TV thought that Kennedy won them because he was better looking and had more style and more flair. And Nixon was never very good on television. But there have been some debates when candidates have made mistakes, whether rightly or wrongly, really caused them to be identified with that mistake. Gerald Ford in 1976 said there was no communist domination of Eastern Europe, and it took him a long time to retract that. George Bush the First apparently misunderstood a question, and somebody asked him about the gross national product or about the economy, and he answered it in the wrong way. And, of course, people, the seminal moment is Dan Quayle, who was in a vice presidential debate, and his Democratic rival said, you're no Jack Kennedy. Now, Quayle ended up getting elected vice president in that election, but that was the end of his career as far as any further national ambitions because he looked like a deer caught in the headlights, and everybody sort of felt that. So, but also, you know, you want to see whether these people can sort of come up with answers and test questions, and I think it's legitimate. If you ask somebody, what would you do if there was a cataclysmic flood like the one in Detroit, what kind of aid would you do, or how would you fix the roads? I think those are things that the voters sometimes can glean some information about what kind of governor this person would be.
And I suspect that the optics of the fact that I want this very crucial job, and yes, I will stand up here before the voters and debate my running, you know, the competitor, is important. It's important to send that out.
In some cases, I don't know about Michigan, but there have been some cases in some states where candidates refuse to debate, and then the other candidate would debate an empty chair. And in some cases, that has been devastating to the candidate who didn't show up.
When you look at, you did comment how Terry Lynn Land has certainly had a problem with the media, and in fact, at the time of the Mackinac meltdown, I remember you put it at the time, not ready for prime time. Gary Peters, very smooth and very good at that. Looking at Rick Snyder and Mark Schauer, who, strengths and weaknesses of both in a debate setting, what do you think?
Well, that's a very good question. Mark Schauer is sort of an unknown. Mark Schauer, neither of these men would win a John F. Kennedy charisma contest. They both have some pluses and minuses. Schauer is not a man. He's a smart, he's a nice and likable man, but he doesn't fill a room. He doesn't overpower everybody with his presence. And he's not the world's best speaker. However, Governor Rick Snyder, and this is not meant as a political comment at all, has one of the worst speaking voices in politics today. People call him Kermit the Frog. He's not a good speaker. He gets tangled up in his words and tangled up in his rhetoric. So it's quite conceivable one of them might make some kind of a gaffe or underwhelm people with their presence. But it's always easier for the challenger because the incumbent has a record that he has to defend. And any incumbent has either made mistakes or had difficult situations. And so incumbents have a harder time in debates than challengers. That doesn't mean they always lose, but what Governor Snyder doesn't want, you see, if you put Snyder right now, he's the governor, the Republican sort of, where they're coming from, their sort of strategy is here's this little challenger, and the governor is busy running the state, and he can't really be bothered with this stuff. But the moment they're both on the stage together, they come across as equals.
What's your prediction, Jack Lesenberry? Will we see debates in either of these statewide races?
I think you will. I think in the governor's race, at the minimum, you'll see one debate on public television and one debate before the Detroit Economic Club. In the Senate race, I just simply don't know. There weren't any debates in the Senate race last time. The candidates couldn't agree on the format. But I think that if we get out there, and if it's October, and Terry Lynn Land is 10 points behind, I think her folks may just push her into a debate. There's also the game, one other thing to consider is the game of lowered expectations. For example, Sarah Palin in her debate, when she was running for vice president, her debate with Joe Biden, she didn't do very well, but by that time, people were so negative on her, and there have been so many negative Sarah Palin is an idiot stories, that she looked good just by not falling flat on her face. So if Terry Lynn Land comes out there and anything like comes close to holding her own with Gary Peters, and I should say, too, that Gary Peters, the joke was that if you asked them what time it was, both of them, Terry Lynn Land would think very hard and finally say daytime, and Gary Peters would give you an hour and a half lecture on how to make a watch. Gary Peters sometimes comes across as being very pedantic and giving people too much detail. And so there's no it's certainly not a sure thing that he's going to knock it out of the park either. And the history of politics is political debates is a history of people surprising people. So I hope, for the sake of the voters, as well as us in the media, we do have debates.
And that's Michigan Radio's political analyst, Jack Lessenberry. And speaking of political debates, it got us thinking about this major moment in presidential debate history. Remember this? November 2011 at Oakland University in Rochester, when Rick Perry served up what was arguably the biggest oops of the presidential campaign when he tried to name the three agencies he would eliminate if he became president.
And I will tell you, it's three agencies of government when I get there that are gone. Commerce, education, and the, what's the third one there? Let's see.
You need five.
Oh, five. Yeah, okay. So five. Commerce, education, and
EPA?
EPA. There you go. No, okay.
Let's talk deposition.
Seriously?
Which, of course, led to Perry's legendary statement that summed it up pretty well. Oops. What are the debate blunders or the debate triumphs that are sticking in your mind through history? And do you feel Michigan voters should see debates between the candidates for our governor and U.S. senator? Let us know. Find us on Facebook. Search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Food holds a special meaning for so many people. In the Jewish culture, food is truly celebrated. It's part of almost every holiday, every tradition. But there can be a dark side. In the Jewish community, more and more women are struggling with dieting and eating disorders. Stateside's Renee Gross reports.
Last Saturday, 23-year-old Judy Blumenthal and her dog took the afternoon off to sunbathe in their backyard in Ann Arbor. Nowadays, Blumenthal enjoys just relaxing in the sun after lunch. But if I visited her when she was 16, it would have been a very different story.
After every single meal, even a tiny little snack, even any food that went into my body, I felt had to be worked off.
Blumenthal had an eating disorder when she was in high school. Back then, she struggled with friends, school, and family, the same things that almost all teenagers struggle with. But unlike other teenagers in her town, Blumenthal is Jewish. Growing up, her family followed all the Jewish traditions, and when she started to struggle with her eating, she took advantage of some of them.
An opportunity to fast, I was happy to take, like when Yom Kippur came up, or when Passover came up with the restricted eating, or when Tisha B'Av came up with the fasts, was always happy to not eat.
Blumenthal also took the Jewish rules of how to eat to a whole new level. One that would support her diet.
In my head, anything fleishig or anything meat was something I couldn't eat. And of course, there were things that were also milchig that I couldn't eat either, like ice cream.
Blumenthal says she was obsessed with being thin. And that may touch on a much bigger issue in Judaism.
Assimilation might be a big factor as well.
That's Dr. Stacy Nye. She's a clinical psychologist in Wisconsin who specializes in eating disorders. She's also Jewish.
If we're genetically predisposed not to look like the ideal woman, and we want to look like everybody else, then, you know, we're at greater risk certainly for dieting and negative body image.
But in the Orthodox community, men and women try hard not to assimilate, and vanity is looked down upon.
In that community, the eating disorder can become a bit of a rebellion, a way to maybe delay puberty and arranged marriage, or a way to rebel against all of the rules, have something else to control when maybe you feel like your whole life is being controlled.
And if you have trouble with food, going to big dinners can feel scary. Blumenthal says she used to panic before Jewish holidays. But with time, she got better. She found other things to focus on.
I started to date my first boyfriend, and I think at that time, a lot of the thoughts and energy went into being, you know, having a relationship with him, and just sort of went off eating.
Now that she's healthy again, Blumenthal says she feels grateful for her Jewish background and her love of nature and the outdoors.
I think that, more than anything, comes from Judaism and a sort of respect for the outdoors and this spiritual connection to, like, a like the trees and the grass and water and sky.
Judaism encourages finding beauty in one's natural surroundings, and that can mean the trees, the water, the grass, but it can also mean appreciation for the way our bodies naturally are, no matter what their shape or size. For Stateside, I'm Renee Gross.
A new book is exploring Michigan's history in the Civil War using photographs of Michigan Civil War reenactors. The book is called American Civil War Years, The Michigan Experience, The Reenactors Telling. Donna Ulrich is editor of this book. Donna, welcome.
Thank you, Cynthia.
And a pleasure to welcome John Gibney, who's an historian. He's an essayist in the book. And John has been a Civil War reenactor since 1960. So you started as a little drummer boy, right, John?
Yes, absolutely.
Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Donna, why did you feel driven to tell Michigan's Civil War story through this book and through the eyes of reenactors?
Because we had thousands of still photographs from a video project we were working on. We have produced a DVD called The American Civil War Years, The Michigan Experience, focusing on Michigan's role in the Civil War. And it airs on public television, and then we have it available on iTunes University and at TeacherTube for teachers to use segments of it in the classroom. iMichigan Productions is a nonprofit educational media company that is doing this kind of work for K-12 curriculum in the state. So we had all the video, and we wanted to make that available to teachers, but then we had all the still photography that our volunteers were shooting, and we didn't want any of that to go to waste either. And we really wanted to pay tribute to these people who are out there in 100-degree weather in wool and, and beautiful storytelling. And it just captured our imaginations. I'm a print girl from way back, so while they're doing all the broadcast work, I needed to do the print work.
So it's a wonderful aid for teachers or for anyone who wants to get a better understanding of the Civil War. And I think it was very interesting choice that you don't focus on the names of the reenactors in this book. Lots of photographs that look for, except for the fact that they're digital and bright color, look like they could have been taken, you know, in 1863. But you're not focusing on their names. What was that choice about?
That was a hard one because there are so many people in there, and trying to identify everybody we thought would be really unwieldy. But we also hoped that it would be more capture people's imaginations without defining who they are today, but rather let them stand for the characters and the people they represent in the time. And most of these reenactors, John will tell you, do incredible research about who they're portraying and have developed the backstory and will talk in first person to you about what their lives are like in the Civil War period. And so that's what we were hoping for, was we'd really capture people's imagination and not interrupt that storytelling.
John, what brought you to be a reenactor all these years ago?
It's a long and vicious tale, but my dad was a Civil War historian and knew Bruce Catton. And my dad was one of the first organizers of Civil War preservation. He fought to keep the National Tower from being built in the middle of Pickett's charge at Gettysburg. And the fact that his best friend was the son of an actual soldier that fought at Gettysburg, so he was a Confederate soldier. My dad never knew his grandfather, who had actually fought in the war. And we figured that because of our background with the Civil War, we should find out more about it. So we went down there for the centennial and ran into this gentleman from North Carolina who became my surrogate grandfather and allowed me, at the tender age of 10 or so, to participate in the centennial events. And I just thought it was the greatest thing in the world. I loved history. It was my favorite subject. But I was bored by what we had in school, and that's nothing but names and dates. It's a math class. So how do you actually find out what it was like? Well, that's by dressing up. At a certain point, it becomes a costume event, though. It's just like going to Halloween. But to actually go there and sleep there, and they talk about the ghosts coming out of the ground, you can feel what some of the things were like, to experience some of the things. But with the cannons going off, the ground shaking, all of that, you can say, you know, this is something that needs to be explained to everybody. Everybody has to experience that. That's when I became a professional. And you know, as a historian, that takes the stuff out of the books that we all love and makes it into something really special.
John has a really good quote, and I don't know whether you can pull it up, but he in the DVD, he talks about taking his daughters, I think, to vote and explaining.
Oh. Yeah, both of my daughters, when they turned 18, I took them to vote, and I said, the blood of every soldier that died is on your hands. You must vote. And it's one of the great things. I remember when I went to vote when Obama was elected the first time, and I saw the flag flying at Allen School. I thought, well, this is an interesting day because this is where the Emancipation Proclamation actually comes to fruition. Mm-hmm. We have to understand this. No matter what side you're on, this is one of those things. The Emancipation Proclamation is probably the most important thing that happened to us in American history other than the Revolution. What are we doing to celebrate that?
When you do reenactments, how give us an idea of the kind of attention to detail that you embrace. And also, are you making up a character? Do you adopt an historic character and say, I am him? How does that fit together?
Well, there's three aspects to living history. There's first person, which is when you do take on that persona. There's third person, which is what 90% of what history is, where you go out and lecture. This is what they did in the third person. But then there's also second person, which is what I've tried to spend most of my life at it. And I would take my clothes and I would say, this is what it feels like. Put on the pants, put on the shirt. I've done this to a lot of teachers. I do a lot of assemblies at schools. And I have the teachers get up and put on red pants and I put on red shirts. And I say, does this make sense? Is this something that you would go off to war with? Well, over 1,000 different regiments went off dressed like Zouaves, colorful Zouaves. I also have people that dress up in green and have black buttons. And I say, this is something called camouflage, as the French would say. And all of a sudden, you have a modern era. You have this incredible spot in history where everything that was glorious before it took place, everything that happened after it is the horror of modern war. That takes place sometime in 1863 where the uniforms start evolving, the guns start evolving, the technology catches up. And 150 years ago at this point, we would be down in Pennsylvania and moving down into Virginia in these huge trenches that looked just like World War I. Now, how they couldn't understand 50 years later that this was the wrong way to fight a war by the lessons of the Civil War, you can't tell.
Yeah.
But that's what we try to find out about this. Why don't these things come across? Sometimes when we put on the uniforms and we peer to the public, they look at us and say, well, what was your life like? If you are doing the first person, you can sit there and say, well, I participated in this battle. This is what my group did. You ask about the authenticity. It's insane, right down to the underwear, right down to the socks, right down to the boots. And it gets to the point where it almost distracts or detracts from what you're saying. So I do professional living history. I've taught classes at Eastern. One of the things I say to my students is there's this thing called the brown thread conspiracy. And that comes from the buttonholes that you have on your uniforms. And you try to figure out whether the uniforms actually came with brown thread at the time or whether the thread has turned brown over the years. So what are you going to put on your uniform? And a lot of people sit there and stare at each other's chest trying to figure out whether or not you have the right number of stitches. And I tell people, it's not the 3-foot thing that we're doing. It's the 6-foot thing. I don't care what you do when I'm looking at you. I care what you do looking at the public because they're the ones that we have to get involved with all this.
I've watched encampments. I've gone to Greenfield Village and seen Civil War reenactors doing encampments. But I've never seen a battle reenactment. And I'm wondering, as you are reenacting a battle, what are you feeling? What are you thinking of?
Well, it's interesting because one of the things that I've sort of stopped doing in the last 20 years is marching around and shooting off guns. In many ways, if you've seen one Civil War battle, you've seen them all. But by the same token, the national events that are so spectacular.
The Gettysburgs.
Phenomenal. And particularly the sesquicentennial events, which were beyond anything I could even imagine. Those give you a taste of what it's like. You wake up because you hear a drum way, way off on the other side of the mountain, and the next drum, and the next drum, and the next drum, until the entire mountain valley is filled with drums. And that's how you actually woke up in the morning. And then you have hundreds of men getting together in these little groups, forming these little small little regiments, and then brigades, and then divisions, and then the entire army is standing there, and from one ridge top to the other. And, of course, there's so much difference in the way the mountains are and the valleys are down there. So it's very difficult to see the beginning and the end of where the regiments are. And then when they actually start fighting, and you disappear in the smoke and you can't even see where you are except for the flags. So you get some kind of a feeling. When we filmed the movie Gettysburg, we had explosions going off. And I remember one of the best scenes in the movie where you can actually see me is grabbing my hat as a bunch of softball-sized pieces of slate and clay come flying down in my head. That's the sort of thing that you never even conceive of. You don't think about explosions going off or people dying, but you get a taste of it because of that. When you experience that, then you can come back and say, well, when they fought, they did this. Then they fought, they did that. And the most important thing is the fact that we're so healthy. These guys ate nothing. They subsisted off of basically hard crackers. And that's all they ate, along with some really rancid bacon. So, of course, the number one killer is dysentery and diarrhea. They never talk about the glory of war and then talk about diarrhea. Well, Clara Barton had typhoid fever while she was basically starting the women's movement in this country in Antietam. Can you imagine having diarrhea in front of 150,000 men? What are you going to do? I mean, these are the sorts of things that when you start experiencing them, and Clara Barton's one of my great heroes, heroines of all time. I can't imagine anybody that put up with more and did more for the women of this country than Clara Barton. Again, it all comes back to the Civil War.
And realizing that Michigan was such a key player, and today, how does Michigan rank with other states as far as the number of reenactors? I was shocked to see how many we had.
We have a good proportion for the Midwest. I mean, obviously, you go out east and there's many, many more people because it's so much closer to them. But we have a goodly number, and we also make up quite a bit of the overall command structure of reenacting in the country. It's all based on military things, but still – the 7th Michigan, which runs Jackson, is a very, very old and wonderful organization. The 17th Michigan, which originally came out of Eastern Michigan, the Normal College had their own company that went off to war. All these things, Michigan is still a primary mover in the reenacting community.
We should let everyone know one of the largest Civil War reenactments in Michigan is the Cascade Civil War Muster, and it's happening August 23rd and 24th in Jackson, and you can get all the details at experiencejackson.com. That would be good to see. And also the book, as we're talking about, American Civil War Years, The Michigan Experience, The Reenactors Telling. You can find out more about that, and I take it the video as well, and teachers' aids by going to americancivilwaryears.com and find out more. And it's very worth while fantastic photos. One final question. If someone was listening and saying, I'd like to do this, I want to be a reenactor, how does one jump into this?
Every single unit has their own headquarters, and just walk up to them and say, I'd like to be involved. We recruit almost every time we go out there, somebody gets involved, and maybe 30, 40 people wind up signing up for units. If you want to be a Confederate, there's Confederate units. If you want to fire cannons, there's cannons galore. If you have a horse and you want to ride, particularly women love participating in the cavalry. There's a lot of female reenactors that ride.
Well, and also SeekingMichigan.com, which is part of the Michigan Historical Center. It's their website. You can go there and find all the information you want on Michigan's sesquicentennial. And we were talking before the show about the fact that it's becoming an older person's activity. So it's not attracting the young and capturing the engaged young person because they're at home playing video games or whatever they're doing.
Yeah.
And also, so many of the park systems are struggling financially, so they're not able to keep the docents and the interpreters in place to tell these stories. And history is learned through storytelling. That's what we know. As John said earlier, it's not about dates and mathematics. It's really about storytelling. And so we need to keep encouraging these future generations of storytellers in Michigan.
Editor Donna Ulrich is with iMichigan Productions in Flint, and Civil War reenactor and historian John Gibney, both with us sharing the American Civil War years, the Michigan experience, the reenactors telling. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. Will Detroit be able to pay its bills after bankruptcy? Bridge Magazine's Mike Wilkinson is reporting on the city post-bankruptcy and beyond. Hello, Mike.
Hello.
And he's joined by one of our regular Stateside voices, Eric Scorsone, Michigan State University professor, expert on municipal finances, and he's now writing a book about Detroit's financial history dating back to the 1950s. Good to have you back, Eric.
Hello.
Mike, there is so much attention right now focused on the right now in Detroit, the grand bargain and winning concessions from workers and retirees and the upcoming bankruptcy trial before Judge Stephen Rhodes. Your piece takes us beyond that. What's the main question you're asking?
Well, I think a lot of people wonder that after Judge Rhodes makes his decisions in court, and whether there's a deal beforehand or not, can the city, with what is removed from its balance sheet, pay the bills that it's going to have? I think there's a suspicion that the city has been cash-strapped for a long time, which it has in lieu of – it has had these bills that have been staggering in terms of its debt. But will it have enough in terms of the money it brings in from the casinos, from income tax, from property tax? Will it have enough to pay what's there?
And as you point out in your piece, Detroit really has some – advantages that other cities don't have in terms of the kind of revenue that comes in, right?
Absolutely. In Michigan, it's the only city that gets the wagering taxes from the casinos to the tune of about $175, $180 million. As Eric well knows, it has a utility tax that no other city levies, 5% on electric, on gas. And it has the highest income tax in the state. It has property tax rate that for large cities, it's the highest in the state. So revenue-wise, I mean, it is taxing a lot of people, a lot of money, and it raises a lot of money. We compared it to a number of other cities, and it's not raising the most per capita of any city, but it's also far from the bottom. I mean, it's raising more money than Cincinnati, Chicago, Kansas City, Orlando in terms of per person, and those are substantial resources.
But as you write in your bridge piece, revenues alone do not a budget make. And for that, Eric Scarsoni, I want to get your thoughts. Assuming that Kevin Orr's plan of adjustment is approved by Judge Rhodes and the billions in debt goes away, does Detroit generate enough money with this revenue to get itself back on track?
To answer that question, we have to think about what is Detroit going to spend the money on, because ultimately that's what really matters. So if the city decides that certain core services and it can manage the cost of those core services, then I think it can make a go of it. And it may identify those, you know, police, fire, whatever those core services are. That's really going to be the critical process. And then decide, can we farm out other things, privatize, outsource? You know, it's going to have to manage it, because the truth is it would be very easy to overspend again, as quite frankly Detroit has in much of its history, and that's going to be the real challenge for the political leadership of Detroit.
And with the experience of having Kevin Orr having the reins of power, and now with Mayor Duggan and his team in place, do you see enough of a change in political leadership to feel confident, shall we say, that Detroit won't slip into those bad old spending habits, Eric?
I'm cautiously confident, I would say. I think there's some good signs right now of maybe some more disciplined spending behavior that is going to go on, but it's going to have to happen for 5 or 10 years, so it's kind of hard to project will that happen in the future, because it's easy to kind of start off on a good base, but then costs start to creep up over time. And so the challenge is in that really maintaining the discipline for many years to come. I think Detroit's run a deficit in about 70% of its fiscal years in the last, say, 50 years. So I think, can we change that behavior? Can we maintain discipline on department spending? Can the mayor ensure that this is what we have to do and other things either aren't going to be done or going to be done by somebody else? And it's going to be hard politically, because there's always going to be demands on mayors and councils to do more, especially in a city like Detroit. So we'll see if they can manage it or not. I'm cautiously optimistic right now.
Yeah, Eric, and we have the situation in the city because of the emergency manager and the position that Mayor Duggan is in, that so many of the tough political decisions are not being made. They don't have to be made. We've had a lot of labor agreements that have come out of this process. And you're right, what's going to happen 5 years now when council has asked for more money for these unions, which have taken such a substantial hit over the years? Decisions that 10, 15, 20, 50 years ago were kind of easy to make in terms of, you know, giving more money, giving loosening the rules on the unions. And yeah, we are going to see a time where the mayor is in control of the budget, the council is in control of some of those reins as well, and now the decisions are going to become political.
I'm speaking with Mike Wilkinson, Bridge Magazine writer, whose piece in Bridge recently is titled, Can Detroit Pay Its Bills Post-Bankruptcy? And Mike's joined by Eric Scarsoni, Michigan State University professor and an expert on city finances, who is writing a book about Detroit's financial history. It dates back to the 1950s. And Eric, really, as we have heard, that is where the root of all of today's miseries really began, didn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, basically, the reason Detroit has an income tax, for example, is because it underfunded its pension systems after World War II. And the only way it could pay for it was to incorporate the first income tax in Michigan, even before the state had one. And there was legal questions at the time of whether that was even feasible, but it ended up happening. Now, you can say, well, that was good because that was a solution. The problem is that solution kind of continued to create problems for the city over time as people responded to incentives by moving out of the city. I'm not going to say the income tax caused all of that, but it certainly contributed. And so even on tax policy, the city's going to have to ask, we have a lot of taxes. Does that really make sense? Maybe we need to reduce some taxes or shift the tax system. The property tax system in Detroit is very problematic. You know, can we make a change there? What does that mean for revenues going forward? So it's not just going to be spending. There's going to be a lot of tax policy questions. The utility user's tax is declining. It's really an antiquated tax at this point. People are getting rid of landlines. You know, how do we really deal with that kind of issue? The other thing we should probably discuss in this context is this control board that's going to be in place.
Yes.
And really, what is their role going to be? And are they going to have the power and authority to, you know, Mike talked about, which he's exactly right, what's going to happen when people are asking for more because they've taken a lot of cuts. And that's, you know, it's understandable, but who's going to put that discipline on? What is the role of that control board?
And what do you see? How do you see, we're looking at tea leaves because we're talking about something that's in the future, but what is your sense, Eric, with respect to what the control board can do or should be doing?
Well, I think similar to New York City, New York is really a model of success, at least financially and probably economically as well. And I think the control board there, you know, did impose a lot of discipline on the city. Things like revenue forecasting was much better done after that. Union contracts were more reasonable. You know, not that there weren't any increases, but they were in line with, you know, cost of living. And I think this control board is going to need staff to be on the ground, you know, really looking at the numbers all the time. I think the control board members are going to be needed to give the authority to say no or to veto certain decisions if they feel they're inappropriate. And the governor, whoever it is in the future, is going to need to kind of keep a hands off, let that board do its work. Hopefully politics won't interfere with it because that would create problems then.
And one of the things we have to talk about at length is as far as looking ahead, and I'd like the thoughts of both of you, we have to talk about the retiree pension and health care costs, this monster legacy debt. And I'm wondering for both of you, is enough being done today by Kevin Orr and his team to help the city out from under these legacy costs and give it a balance sheet that is sustainable for the future? Mike, what did you find?
Well, I mean, the issues that he first attacked were on this level. I mean, he's gone in and kind of gutted the health care responsibilities as he could. That was not constitutionally protected in Michigan, unlike the pensions. And he's gone after a couple of the big problems. One, the swaps deal that was the architect was the Kwame Kilpatrick administration, and that's one of the problems we have. One of the biggest insurers is challenging an attempt to erase a substantial amount of that debt. So he's going after that, and that alone was contributing, you know, $200 million to the expenditures of the city. So it is an important thing that he had to do, whether or not it is enough, because a lot of people are going to feel pain at the other end of this, whether it's a retiree or it's a current worker. You know, it is a legacy cost. I mean, Eric mentioned, I mean, we had the income tax. We have an income tax that's added to the city's, you know, revenue basket that didn't really create any additional services for the city so much as, you know, they didn't say, okay, we're gonna open a bunch of parks, we're gonna do this for schools. It was to pay off this legacy debt. So maybe it's an attempt to kind of right that ship a little bit, but whether or not it's enough, again, we won't know until it all comes out in the wash.
What's your sense, Eric?
I think it's workable. I think certainly the retiree health care burden was the biggest problem facing the city. And I think that has been addressed. So that helps in the short term. But, you know, as I said before, it's going to come down to discipline, because even if you reduce the debt burden, and we see this in a lot of corporate bankruptcies, corporations go in, they reduce the debt, and then 3 years later, they're back in bankruptcy. And it's going to be the same challenge for Detroit. Can it maintain discipline, spend only what it needs to spend, maintain cost control, budget control? And if it can do that, then I think it can manage through this process, and the debt burden reduction will be significant and probably enough.
So let's say that the discipline can be achieved and those financial decisions can happen. Are there not deep-rooted problems that make it almost impossible to believe that Detroit can go forward and upward, whether we're talking poverty and unemployment rates and property values? Is that too much holding Detroit back to offset any of the kind of hard work that's being done now?
I think we have to remember, Detroit sits in the context of a a state and a country that is facing really significant economic challenges right now. The bankruptcy is going to help, and I think it'll help stabilize city government, but that's different from the city itself, and I think we would expect any city to provide basic municipal services. That's not really a competitive advantage. That's something you should be doing. We got to get that right. But let's remember, you know, we have a country facing a lot of long-term unemployed people, an economy that's not really growing at its full potential. You know, as the U.S. continues to struggle economically from this recession, I don't think we can expect Detroit to do dramatically better necessarily until the country and even the state kind of comes back to normal.
So I hear you saying there's nowhere to go but up, but let's not overpromise where things could go.
When you're really low, you can absolutely come up. And it's already happening. We know this. We can look at downtown and midtown and see the things happening, the excitement. And that's fantastic, and I hope it continues. But for the broader city, my concern is, are we going to see a city of two have and have-nots? Because, you know, what's going to happen with the neighborhoods, you know, versus midtown, downtown? You know, I mean, the M1 rail is going to help. But, again, that's really only serving that corridor. We're going to have to see where it goes over the next few years.
We see such blight and poverty and almost hopelessness 4 miles off of Woodward in any direction. And a lot of the money,
if not even closer.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, yeah, I apologize. Yeah. I mean, in some cases, it's hundreds of yards. You know, we have a commitment from Kevin Orr to spend $1.4 billion from the savings. Again, you know, financing some of the operating expenditures here. And a lot of that money is probably going to be poured into the neighborhoods to fix with lighting, to make sure that the blight is removed, that the lights are on, that the police are on patrol.
Mike Wilkinson is the computer-assisted reporting specialist at Bridge Magazine. His piece, Can Detroit Pay Its Bills After Bankruptcy?, from a recent edition at BridgeMI.com. And Eric Scorsone, Michigan State University municipal finance expert. Always good to talk with you, Eric. And Mike, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Pinkerton security firm has certainly made its mark on history. Founded in 1850, Pinkerton has been connected to everyone from President Lincoln to Jesse James. Now the famed security company is moving its global headquarters to Michigan. Jack Zarin is president of Pinkerton. Jack, why'd you decide to move from New Jersey to Ann Arbor?
Well, we looked at a number of factors, but for us, it was really important for us to come back to the Midwest because essentially that's where Pinkerton was born. So that was kind of, I think, first decision. So from there, we kind of looked at the talent pool here, which was very important, being close to high-tech employees because that's given the direction we're going as an organization. But for me personally, I have personal ties to the region, being born and raised in Windsor, Ontario, but did all my professional schooling in Michigan. It felt really as the right thing to do to come try to bring the organization back here.
So here you are, and when you think about the fact that here you are sitting at the summit of 164 years of history, why do you think Pinkerton has lasted for 164 years?
You know, to be in the role I am, it is a little humbling because when you look at the history, but I think the one thing that enabled us to be relevant all this time is, I think, the nature of what we do. Being in the, I guess, the risk management business, so to speak, it forces us to always try to be ahead of the curve, because if we're doing right for our clients and helping them mitigate against threats and risks, it forces us to always try to be ahead of that curve. And I think because of that, it has enabled us to kind of be relevant and timely all these years.
So when you think that the original Pinkerton men, Alan Pinkerton and his two sons who kind of took over after the Civil War, were out there chasing down Butch and Sundance because the railway companies were sick of being robbed, that was what was needed in 1870. How has the company changed and adapted? What's the threat situation look like in 2014?
No, that's a good question. I think much like back then, we have an environment where things are moving very rapidly. So in terms of the threat landscape, I would say the top threat today didn't exist 2 years ago. And the top threat 2 years from now doesn't exist today.
What's the top threat today?
Top threat on a lot of organizations' minds is cybersecurity. But you also have a lot of interest in workplace violence, because that seems to be a topic that and an area of focus that's really important. But also understanding global commerce and being in the exposures that that creates, because we're in a more connected economy, and so there's a lot more uncertainty as organizations have to kind of expand out into markets they've never been before. So you know that creates a whole host of factors a lot of companies never had to think about.
So instead of the kind of agents that that Alan Pinkerton might have hired, who had to have, for example, good horseback riding skills to work a territory in the West, it sounds like you're going for people with great IT skills and that type of skill set.
We're definitely getting more information driven, just like a lot of other organizations. So that that requires a different skill set. Yeah, look, we're not on horseback anymore, and so we're protecting things in a digital space now, along with still doing a lot of the physical work. So yeah, it definitely forces a change in profile.
What do you think tough little Scotsman Alan Pinkerton would say if he saw you parked on Main Street in Ann Arbor and dealing with the international cybersecurity?
You know, I would think he would be happy that we're back in the Midwest. You know, obviously this is where the roots of the company. It's kind of where Pinkerton was born. You know, I think Alan Pinkerton was an innovator. He was known for bringing a lot of things to the sector, so to speak, like the invention of taking a mugshot. He helped bring forward the first criminal database, things like this. Just the term private eye, which is really comes from the original logo, which is our logo today is a version of that. You know, it's the unblinking eye. So that spirit of we never sleep. You know, those are some of the things that are still important to the company. So I would think Alan would be happy that we're continuing to be innovators and we still have the spirit of we never sleep and being that unblinking eye and doing what's right for our clients.
And now doing it based in Michigan. Yep. Jack Zaran, president of the historic Pinkerton Company, moving headquarters from New Jersey now to Ann Arbor. Thanks so much, Jack.
Thanks for having us.
Stateside was produced and directed today by Allie Billings. Our engineer was Bob Scon. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Contributors are Mike Blank, Emily Fox, and Brianna Tinsley. Support for arts and culture coverage on Stateside comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs and the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.